Hey, everybody, it's Terry McDougall, your host at Marketing Mambo. And my guest today is Kevin Windorf, CEO of the Financial Communications Society. Kevin is a native New Yorker, a creative through and through, and a very interesting and entertaining guy. He and I worked together for a number of years, and one of my memories of him is early in my tenure at that job. He and I were both going to an offsite meeting of our larger marketing department in Toronto, and he called me before we were leaving, and he said, "Brush up on Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen. We're going to use that in our presentation to the greater marketing department." And I kind of laughed it off. I just figured he's quite the jokester. But sure enough, he had rewritten the words to Bohemian Rhapsody to include what we did in U.S. marketing, and we performed that in tie-dye t-shirts in front of our entire marketing department. And that was my true introduction to Kevin and his multitude of talents. So I think you're really going to enjoy our conversation. He is a very interesting and energetic person who's a master networker, talented writer, incredibly wise marketer. He's got a lot to share. So now, without further ado, let the Mambo begin.
Welcome to Marketing Mambo with your host, Terry McDougall. It's the fun and fast podcast where we chat with marketing movers and shakers from around the globe.
Hey, everybody, it's Terry McDougall with another episode of Marketing Mambo. And my guest today is Kevin Windorf. Kevin is a longtime marketing expert. He is the CEO of the Financial Communications Society. He also is the client strategy director at Living Group and author and publisher of short fiction as well. So, Kevin, you're a busy man. Welcome to Marketing Mambo. How are you?
Great, Terry. Thanks so much. I really enjoy being here. This is exciting for me because I've been listening to Marketing Mambo since you first started. It's been a terrific place, a great forum to hear marketers from so many different disciplines. I'm delighted to geek out with you today on some financial marketing.
Good. Well, there's nothing better than being able to talk to another marketing geek because I know that you love it as much, if not more, than I do. And there's no further proof than the fact that you have been involved in the Financial Communications Society, which is a professional association for marketers and communicators in the financial services realm for a long, long time. So tell us more about that. I was a member for a while and great people. So tell us more about the FCS.
I'd love to, because I'm a true evangelist for the FCS. So interestingly, the Financial Communications Society was born in 1967. And no, I did not start it, although some people think that I'm that old. But back in 1967, there was a group of advertising and PR professionals who were getting together on a regular basis, like so many of us used to do, in person at this famous financial district bar in Manhattan called Harry's at Hanover Square. And they decided to formalize their networking meetings, and they launched what was then called the Advertising and PR Association of Wall Street. So that took root, and 3 years later, in 1970, they changed the name to the Financial Communications Society. So this has been going on for decades. You know, people in the business, financial marketing, it is such a unique world, learning how to work together to improve careers, improve professions, et cetera. I would say the modern history of the FCS really begins around 1995 when we launched the Portfolio Awards. The woman who was president at the time, Karen Quinn, she created this concept of let's have our own award show because, again, financial marketing is so challenging and specific and differentiated. So the Portfolio Awards took off really as an opportunity to focus on financial advertising. And it's had this long history going back to 95. Now, I got involved in 2001, was when I went to my first event. And, you know, to cut the story real quick, I got voted onto the board in 2005, got elected president in 2009. One of the very first things I wanted to do was expand what the Portfolio Awards was recognizing. And that was an absolute reflection of what folks like you and I were doing day in and day out as financial marketers. We weren't just doing advertising. There was so much more to what we were doing. Back then, we used to think of ourselves as marketing generalists. Now, of course, we use the label integrated marketing. So we very carefully have curated the Portfolio Awards competition since 2010 to begin to include other categories in reflection of what marketers do day in and day out. So over time, we added PR, we added collateral. In 2013, we blew up the whole notion of digital media. Fast forward to today, we now have over 40 categories in which we recognize the work of financial marketers and communicators. And what's really interesting is just last year, we expanded the competition to include what we're calling the financial industry. So it's not just financial institutions, you know, your banks, your brokerages, your asset managers. But now we're recognizing that there are players in the industry dedicated to financial services that are doing great marketing communications work on their own behalf, for their own brands. And they deserve the recognition. So that's companies that might be in the fintech space or professional associations or media companies and every ilk of agency from digital communications, PR, advertising, everyone who plays in the space, we feel they're part of our community. And that's what we like to do with the Portfolio Awards is recognize all the players and all the great work that we do.
Yeah, that's so awesome. And I was privileged a few years ago to be a judge for the Portfolio Awards. And I was thrilled because it's just so amazing to see the cool things that different organizations are working on. And you're absolutely right. And full disclosure, you and I work together. I was really surprised to see that it's been going on 12 years since we last worked together. It doesn't seem like that long ago. But we both worked in marketing for an investment bank. And you're absolutely right. I mean, we were doing some advertising, but probably the bulk of our investment in marketing was in different categories. Besides that, lots of conferences, lots of in-person events, direct mail. I mean, running the whole gamut, email marketing, other digital marketing. So I am happy because, I mean, I think it's sexy, but for some people, they might not think it's the sexiest kind of marketing that's out there. So it's fun to be among others who think it is sexy stuff.
I like to think that it brings the best of both worlds. There, on the B2C side of financial marketing, there's definitely the opportunity to be sexy, if you will, but it comes with all of the baggage of regulations and the sentiment that you have to build up. And of course, on the B2B side, it's really challenging. It's your swim lane is very, very narrow. And I find that it takes a certain type of marketer to succeed, to thrive in this environment, to be able to do all of those marketing successes, you know, being able to attract, persuade, and drive to action. But in an environment, a landscape where you're really handcuffed sometimes with language, or you think about in the old days, we would have to give up at least a third of a print ad for disclosures and disclaimers.
True.
And forget about going into TV and what the voiceover has to reveal at the end. But, you know, the part of it, and again, this notion of the Portfolio Awards recognizing creative excellence, we actually have a Hall of Fame for winners. When you think about campaigns like MasterCard and Priceless, or even going back in time a little bit to Charles Schwab and Talk to Chuck, there are opportunities for marketers to rise above, if you will, and really create lasting and very effective marketing. And that's what we look to do with our award show. We also do an annual Financial Marketer of the Year, where we recognize a specific executive as well as the company. And these two components of recognition are part of this long tradition. You know, this year, it's the 28th annual FCS Portfolio Awards. This year will be the 17th annual FCS Financial Marketer of the Year Award. These are two really important competitions and events, but they're only part of what we do. Now, when we think about the FCS mission, it's simple 3 points: community, education, and philanthropy. Everything you were just reacting to, Terry, about that we work together and it doesn't feel like it was that long ago, that's because there's this small world component to the financial marketing community. And that's what we always say, is our mission begins with community. And we are all about connecting folks in every component of their career, whether they're just starting out or they're up at the CMO level. We bring them together. And you know, right now we have more than 800 dues paying members. We've got more than 50 corporate members across the country. On LinkedIn, our followership in our group is nearly 2,000 people. There's this constant ebb and flow of people touching financial marketing and communications, and that we connect all of them. Part of how we do that is through our events. Pre-pandemic, we were hosting as many as 55 in-person events across the country. We started in New York when I was put in charge back in 2009. My first mandate was to make us national. So as you well know, we're in Chicago, we're in Boston and Philadelphia, we're in Charlotte and San Francisco, and we've held events in LA, DC, Milwaukee, and Denver. And we hope that as our national community gets more accustomed to going back to in-person events, that we'll be in all of these chapters again before the year is out. Because one of the things that we're looking to do is not just bring people back together, but the third component of our mission is philanthropy. And we support children's charities. We are eager to get back in person to have more successful, profitable, ongoing events to help drive our philanthropic mission. Now, since the year 2000, we've donated more than $2.7 million to children's charities. And even as we've pivoted over the last year and a half to a digital virtual event organization, we've continued to support children's charities. We now have nearly 30 children's charities that we have supported in the last year and a half. And this is really something, when we think about the community and the small world, this really brings us all together. I joked up front about geeking out with you. Yes, we're pretty much all marketing geeks. That's what brings us together.
Yeah.
But what's really sustainable about our organization is the idea that we have this philanthropic mission as well.
Yeah, that's so awesome. And I think that one of your big charitable events is a ski race or something, right? Don't you go up to...
Yeah, we do FCS Race for Kids up in Stowe, Vermont. We just held our 22nd annual. We skipped 2021, but right here, January 2022, we were back up in Vermont. We had 125 fully vaccinated people come up. It's yes, there is skiing. Obviously, that's why we're in Vermont. And 100% of the net proceeds go to three children's charities. And give a shout out to Downside Adoption Agency, Hope and Heroes, Columbia University Medical Center, and Make-A-Wish Foundation of Vermont.
Yeah, that's so great.
But a key thing about that weekend is that there is a business component. It is a true marketing summit. And we do 3 evenings and afternoons of panel discussions. And we get CMOs and marketers as well as executives from agencies come up. And it's a fantastic opportunity to basically what we're doing here, right? You know, having conversations about meaningful marketing trends and activities marketers are planning for the coming years.
Yeah, well, I unfortunately never got to go to that event, but I did tear my ACL at Stowe. So I'm not sure that it would be a good revisiting for me.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Yeah, I think I've skied once since then on some small hill in Wisconsin. Thank you for going into so much detail about this. And I was really happy when the FCS came to Chicago because I'd been part of some other B2B marketing associations. And it's great to get together with other B2B marketers, which is what I've done for the majority of my career in financial services. But it's more of a niche when you get into B2B financial services marketing. I actually met somebody at one of the lunches in Chicago when I had left and become a consultant and a coach. But I sat next to him and found out that he did copywriting for investment banking and wealth management and asset management. And I was like, oh my gosh, where have you been my entire career? Because as you know, it is such a specialized arena, and particularly when you get into supporting some of the more exotic products and services, you really need a deep well of knowledge. You need to be a marketer, but you need to understand the marketplace. You need to understand what's going to influence potential customers. You need to be able to interact with these people that are, you know, eating and sleeping exotic services in financial services every day. And it, like you said, it's a narrow lane that you've got to live within. And so it's really nice to be able to interact with other people that are in that arena. So
yeah, it's interesting that you picked up on right away that finding a financial writer is like almost a needle in a haystack. And then when you find him, you want to hold on to him. I have to say, I am very grateful that I'm a writer by nature, by trade, by training and experience, and it's made all the difference in the world to my career. You know, I was on the client side for a little more than 30 years, and I hate to talk about that. I just like to say I started last century. But there was a period where I had only worked for banks and for 30 years. Going back to high school, my first job was at Chemical Bank. For those of you who can remember some of the old, good old brands, and that allowed me to get a full-time job when I worked my way through college. And when I was in college, I was working on a communications degree because, again, I was a writer. But I spent the beginning of my career working at Chemical Bank, and then we bought Manufactured Hanover, Manny Hanny, for, again, old fans. And I was on the operations side. And what I always found very grateful for is that when I got into private banking, I got good exposure to a woman who's head of sales. And she recognized my writing skills. And again, because you don't find it that often, she encouraged me. This woman, Susan Johnston, encouraged me to pursue marketing. And in 94, I was able to make a move out of operations and go into marketing. And that basically is where my career changed. I immediately decided to go back and get an MBA focusing on marketing. And that just became a great door opener for me. I wound up becoming director of marketing communications for what was Chase Manhattan Private Bank. I wound up leaving and going to Deutsche Bank, where I ran the product team in institutional businesses. I had a team in London, Frankfurt, and Singapore. And basically, back then, everything was print. I was doing nothing but writing for six different product areas. And then from there, I had this wonderful opportunity to join a small Wall Street firm called Gerard Clower Madison, which had been in business 11 years, but never had anyone doing marketing. So a friend of mine, a fellow named Sean McGowan, brought me in to be their director of marketing. And we spent 3 years there. My mandate, the CEO said, basically, I use the expression polish the apple, because they were looking to either merge, acquire something, or be acquired. And lo and behold, that's exactly what happened. So 2003, Bank of Montreal came to town and bought our little New York equity shop, if you will. And that became my career with BMO Capital Markets. And we got to get to work together. And across this really long career of mine on the financial client side, I've always been most proud of the work that you and I did with our colleagues up in Toronto on creating the brand BMO Capital Markets. And in hindsight, you look at it and you think it was this should have been the simplest process to come up with that name. But what we went through for a couple of years, the different iterations in order to get there, you really learn a lot about the marketing process, about institutional audiences specifically, and a little bit about people, psychology, and personality.
Oh, my gosh. A lot about people. And yeah, you were in the New York office and I was in the Chicago office. And I came in right as we were getting ready to start the research on that. And it was my grand welcome to, at that point, was Harris Nesbitt.
Yeah, exactly.
That was the name. Yeah. Everybody said, oh, I know what a Harris is, but what's a Nesbitt?
Yeah, we had the challenge of combining Nesbitt Burns, Harris, BMO, and again, where I was coming from was Gerard Clower Madison. So we had Harris Nesbitt Gerard for about 10 months, and then it was Harris Nesbitt for a couple of years.
Yeah, I can remember sitting down with the bankers, and this is really interesting. And this is something that I talk to people a lot about as marketers, that sometimes you've got to go into that intersection, or you've got to go to where the tough stuff is. Like, you got to go to where the friction is. And I can remember when we were doing that research to figure out, are we going to rebrand? And if so, what's this new name going to be? Sitting down with different pockets of bankers. And I remember one guy coming in and he threw like four business cards on the table. Every business card had a different name on it. And he said, over the last 3 years, these are the business cards that I've been given and told to go out and drum up business. He's like, I end up going into every conversation having to explain why I've got a new name. And that wastes the time. I don't get time to talk about why they should do business with our organization. So I just remember it wasn't always really comfortable to be in marketing to sit down with these people and hear their pain. I mean, it's funny because I think a lot of people think of branding as just, oh, the pretty colors or the logo or the fun stuff that marketers do. But the reality is that there is a lot of meaning and emotion that goes into branding, right? Because,
absolutely.
I mean, absolutely. To the point of the pain that this banker was feeling of having to put himself on the line to go out and try to develop business, but being forced to go in with like a different name every 6 months or something, that had to be painful, right? He wants to focus on, let me talk to you about the great things that we can do for you, not about why we've changed our name again.
Think about how those conversations could have been different if you were already a life coach then and you could have gone in. We definitely played therapist, especially yes. The folks on the sales side. What you're talking about, the emotional side of branding, I have to say that that's something that marketers today fully get. They fully embrace that. But even as recent as 10 years ago, I don't think financial marketers really understood that. Mm-hmm. You know, when we were coming out of the financial crisis, there was such a focus on how do we build back trust. Every sentence was about trust. How are they ever going to trust us again? And I think it took a little bit of time, but this whole notion of determining through the client experience how to be authentic. And one thing we as marketers have always been sensitive to, we could go and do amazing advertising work, but if the client experience doesn't own up to what the brand is promising, then it's going to fall flat. It's an empty promise. And marketing has no control of how to train people. We can't determine how an ATM is going to work. But when a financial company is able to deliver on their promise of the brand, whether it's in a physical location like a bank branch, it's an experience with a call center, or if it's a digital experience on a website or an app, that's when it all comes together. And I do think that right now, I would say in the last 3 to 5 years, leaving the pandemic to the side, that financial marketing is probably at its all-time best because we've really been able to win the clients back. They trust us now more than ever. We've done very well in things like the Edelman Trust Barometer. And it's because the marketing has been authentic, but the client experience behind it is mm-hmm. elevated and basically proving that what we're claiming is true.
Yeah, it's funny because client experience, just that term, is relatively new. I mean, you and I are right around the same age. And so, you know, if you think back to getting our start in the 80s or working through the 90s and all of that, like nobody was talking about customer experience. I mean, maybe they might be talking about customer service or something like that. And I've talked about this a lot, that part of what marketing's role is to serve as the client advocate, to put ourselves in the position of the client and say, what are they experiencing? And it is fulfilling to know that this is a term that is being used, not just by people in marketing, but by others, leaders in organizations. And this also gets to a topic that I've talked to a lot of my guests about, and that is whose responsibility is the health of the brand or the expression of the brand. And certainly I would argue that it's everybody's in the whole organization. But I think that traditionally, and going back to earlier times in my career, people would say, hey, well, marketing, there's an issue with the brand. You guys need to fix it, right? What thoughts do you have on that topic?
So it's a very interesting angle. And again, I think here's the scenario where within the last couple of years, we've made advances. And I'm speaking to that because one of the great advantages of working through the FCS is exposure to so many of our CMOs who come on our, whether it's the physical stage or the virtual stage, to share their stories. And the key element that I keep hearing from these successful brands is that at the CMO level, they are finally getting a seat at the table. So when you talk about whose responsibility is it for the brand? Yes, you and I can date back to when marketing was something down the hall from the corner office, and we were an expense. We had to go fix things to make them look pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, the CMO, armed with all of the skills on branding, but also all of the analytics that come in from being able to digitally measure stuff, and that CMO has a seat at the table as a partner. And it's not just the CEO and the CMO, but it's everyone else at that table who recognizes that the brand is the company, the brand are the employees, the brand is the client experience. And all of this fits together as one giant puzzle piece. And, you know, they live and die together.
Yeah, I think that measurement has made a lot of difference, because there was a time when, I got my start in direct mail. And of course, you can measure, but it just takes a lot longer. Right. And so a lot of times you were just making decisions based on your gut or what worked on the last campaign or whatever. And now things can be measured in real time. But I also think that one of the things that can be a little problematic with that is that there are some things that are valuable that are hard to measure. And sometimes you do have to kind of rely on somebody's experience or gut. What would you say about that? Because I feel like sometimes the pendulum's almost swung to one extreme where it's like, oh, we should be able to measure everything. And I'll just give you an example of in one of the last roles that I had at my last company, I worked in the asset management group and institutional sales. And the sales cycle was about 24 months. And I was competing for marketing dollars with businesses that were a lot more agile and they could guarantee a payback on the investment within less than a year. What are your thoughts on that? Like, where should the balance be between art and science?
You know, that's an interesting argument. And this topic comes up a lot. And it's interesting when you use the expression about the pendulum having swung too far. And I do think that from time to time, we do see it come back a little bit more towards what I'll think of as the qualitative versus the quantitative. Mm-hmm. And I don't think a data scientist is going to ever be the most successful CMO, but a CMO who knows how to interpret the data and can be analytical will be more successful than someone who just knows how to express a point in words and pictures. It really needs to be a balance. You do have to be the artist and the scientist to make it happen. But don't lose sight. You need to be a leader, and the success of the leader is knowing how to bring in all the different components. I would say that given the availability of technology, when you have time, it would always be foolish to miss the opportunity to do any kind of testing, no matter what it is, as far as a marketing initiative. I will share that when I left the client side and I went to the media side, I did have a very interesting 3-year stint at CNBC. Selling advertising, although I never, ever liked to say that I was selling advertising. I really believe that I was there selling the brand, connecting the CNBC brand with so many financial clients. That's where my exposure to the importance of measurable ROI really kicked in.
Of course.
And when you start wringing your hands over the eyeballs for every 30-second spot on a TV program, it gives you an appreciation for the idea that all of that marketing budget does have to have a payoff at some spot, at some point.
Yeah, definitely.
I was just going to say, to again tie it back to the FCS, one of the reasons behind portfolio awards, celebrating creative excellence and not asking for ROI as a measure is because we don't want to lose sight of the importance of the artistry, if you will, of everything we do. Because that creative component has to win the audience before you can start measuring them.
Yeah, so true. Yeah, so true. As you were talking, going back to something you said earlier about the CMO having a place at the table, I think the fact that things are so much more measurable and the CMOs have access to data, honestly, I think that's what's won them the seat at the table. Because if you think, who's sitting at the table? It's the CEO, it's the CFO, it's the COO, you know, maybe the CHRO. I think that in the past, people kind of looked at marketing as this black box, right? Like, I don't know how they do what they do, but actually, it's funny when you were talking earlier about marketing making it pretty. I worked earlier in my career at a subsidiary of Marsh McLennan, it was a third-party insurance administrator. And the head of sales used to walk through marketing. He'd bring clients through. And every single time he came through, the way that he described our area was, this is where all the fun stuff happens.
Right, right.
And I was like, oh yeah, you know, it's like a barrel of monkeys. Hilarious. But it's interesting sometimes to think about how marketing can be viewed.
You know, one of the things you just mentioned when you're talking about who's sitting at the table, you mentioned the chief human resources officer. I really think one of the things that is overlooked in marketing communications conversations is the important role of connecting marketing and HR. And for a couple of reasons. Number one, like marketing, HR should not be thought of as a cost center.
Agreed.
You know, your greatest assets will be your people and should be an investment. And I think what we're seeing right now, the great resignation and the war on talent, is really proving the point of how important having a great, diverse employee base is for the ongoing sustainable success of a company. But the connection with marketing is really important. You know, we have always recognized the importance of employees as brand ambassadors. And throughout my career, I've always used as an example, when we did the launch of the BMO Capital Markets brand, we really were very smart about making sure that we brought in the employees around the world. Granted, it was primarily the US and Canada, but it's a global brand. We made sure that they were totally bought into what we were doing with the brand. And I think that is a great opportunity for marketers to always think about their relationship with HR, not just as another division, but part of a team. And again, to tie it back to Portfolio Wars, this is something we did last year. We introduced the category of employee communications in recognition of how important it is that, yes, you might go off and launch a new brand, create a new website, have a new digital campaign. But if you're not bringing your employees, if you're not teaching your employees what your brand is all about, if you're not sharing the messaging internally, it's a lost opportunity to be able to amplify what your brand is trying to achieve.
Yeah, I agree with that. And when I think back to our time working at BMO Capital Markets, in many ways, it was kind of idyllic. I mean, not that it was ever easy at all. It was probably one of the most challenging jobs that I ever had, but it was also the job that I held for the longest. And part of it was because there was such an integration with the business. I mean, when I think about, yeah, we were doing advertising in the Wall Street Journal and doing big multi-day investor conferences and all kinds of big, cool things. But I was involved in writing new hire announcements, right? Mm-hmm. So like there was a connection with HR calling and saying, oh, we've got a new banker starting next week and here's his bio. Just being that like finger on the pulse of the organization. And there is some skill sets that marketers have. This is a little bit of a double-edged sword, I would say. There's skill sets that marketers have that are very valuable, not only within the marketing realm, but elsewhere. And I know as a marketing leader that sometimes I had to sort of put up a firm boundary so that people weren't coming in and being like, hey, help me with my sales presentation or something like that, right? Because you've got people that are great writers and communicators and designers. And as a leader, you want to focus their efforts on the marketing stuff, not get frittered away by everybody that's like, hey, I want you to write this thing for me. But it was really fulfilling to be a catalyst in a lot of different areas to help with the cohesion of the organization.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think of it now in hindsight as the good fortune during my 10 years on Wall Street. I always was, the expression would be co-located with HR. They were always, if not in the office next to me, within the same corner. And yes, that meant sometimes people were knocking on the door looking for some writing help, but it also ensured that I was always part of that conversation. I heard what was going on. And in fact, I would like to point out that probably one of the greatest leadership lessons I ever got was when I first joined a marketing organization back in 94 at what was Chemical Bank. The woman in charge's name is Jatel Cardin. By example, she taught me this lesson that it's incredibly important to share information with your team. And she would tell us everything that was going on. So we, as her marketers, who were each assigned to support specific divisions and departments, we always understood what was going on. What was management thinking? What were the business strategies? You know, we didn't have to get into the personality issues, but we knew more than most salespeople, for example. And that taught me the importance of understanding everything inside an organization. What is it thinking today? Where is it looking to go? When a marketer can be associated with an HR person and be part of this conversation, exactly to your point, Terry, you are able to think cohesively about the brand, what it should be saying internally, and how does that get expressed externally?
Yeah, I think that when organizations don't have marketing at the table, and hopefully, to your point, this is evolving and it's maybe in the rear view rather than what we're looking at going forward. But I've certainly seen it where people are like, oh, well, you don't need to be involved until it's baked and we just need to make it look pretty, right? And that's, I think the way that marketers think, it's valuable to have them as part of these conversations earlier. And to your point, understanding, I've seen it a lot where senior leaders are huddling with HR because they're thinking about, okay, well, where are we going and what kind of talent are we going to need going forward to make this happen? If the organization is evolving, marketing also needs to be there to be like, how are we going to talk about this in the marketplace? How are we going to make sure that this is sort of spliced into the DNA within the organization? Because you brought this word up earlier, authenticity. The strongest brands are that through and through, right? It's like what they appear to be is what they are. And it goes back to customer experience, right? It's like, okay, you can go out there and you can buy an expensive ad or put on a big conference or do whatever your activity is. You can do that in marketing. Marketers are talented, right? Like we can make stuff look awesome and we can communicate it really well. But if it does not reflect what somebody's experience is with the organization, with the brand, it's going to break that trust. They're going to say, you're not what you appear to be. And so it is really important to know, like, well, where are we going? So I can make sure that I'm communicating this to people.
And that goes back to, you know, what we talked about being invited to be at the table. And I've been on the agency side for, well, the last 7 years, either working independently or at different agencies. But over this time, I've realized that there's nothing more valuable to an agency partner than being invited into the process very early on. Like an in-house marketer, we need to know as soon as possible, what's the vision? What's the business objective? And then allow us as the creative experts, if you will, to come back to you and say, here's the path to the client experience, whether that's B2C or B2B, there's still an experience. If you're out there marketing something, ultimately you're selling something, and sometimes you're just selling an idea, there's still an experience. And your best agency partner will be someone who has been brought in early on and can help develop and evolve with the client what the right concepts are. So this is something that I've been able to benefit in the last couple of years on the agency side, taking all of that internal experience as an in-house marketer and be able to now work with multiple clients to really get at what they're trying to achieve, primarily in brand strategy, or I mentioned I do a tremendous amount of writing still, anything on the content strategy. I went from the client side to CNBC, and then I went on to the agency side, and there was a good stretch there. I was an independent consultant. But in that stretch alone, I've worked with 250 different financial firms, primarily small funds, wealth managers. And when you're working one-on-one with smaller shops like that, you really get into the weeds at the very beginning of what they're trying to do. And for me personally, career-wise, this has been wonderfully satisfying to be able to name a company. I've named probably 30 companies in the last 5 years, and then be able to establish their brand, get their brand positioning, begin the whole communications, which leads to the client experience.
Yeah.
Also, the idea of being able to take, it's not so much a formula, but it's an approach, and being able to apply it to large global brands as well. In my current job, it's really, again, very satisfying. And I don't think I could have gotten here if I didn't have all of those years of experience at the different large banks that I worked for, in Chase and Deutsche Bank and BMO.
Yeah, well, I would imagine, just as you were talking about that, and this has sort of been my experience too, is that when you work in these larger organizations, you do a lot of different things, right? But I think a lot of marketers are sort of like on to next, right? It's like, okay, yeah, we just did a, like a giant rebranding that took a year and a half, but you know, on to next, we've got other other challenges. And I think as you were talking about working with these smaller organizations, probably walking in the door, you might not have even been aware of the depth and breadth of knowledge, not just about marketing, but about a lot of other strategic areas that they might need to take into consideration as they're establishing their brand that you were bringing to the table. Because you just absorb a lot when you're doing a lot over the years. One thing that I wanted to ask you about was what it's like marketing a professional association. I mean, you've been on the client side, you've been on the agency side, and now you're working in, for all intents and purposes, a nonprofit. It serves marketing and it serves the financial industry. But how is that different from what you've done in your career?
Well, the important qualifier you have to put on that, what's it like to market a not-for-profit that has zero marketing budget? And again, because we support children's charities, we really look to be as lean and mean as possible. We do not spend money on marketing. I will say that there are two areas that we focus on, and we've already touched on one of these already. That whole notion of what I talked about as employees being brand ambassadors. Everyone who comes through the FCS, whether they're a board member, a committee member, or someone who's been on our stage or in our audience, we look at them all as brand ambassadors. I have never encountered anyone who's ever come back to me and said, that FCS event was not worth my time or my money. And that gives me the encouragement that these people are then going out to everyone else they encounter and saying, this was a great use of my time and money. You need to go there too. That's how I got first involved. It was a saleswoman from CNBC.com, interestingly, selling me my very first piece of digital advertising. She told me about the FCS. And I went, and the idea, and it was, Terry, exactly like your experience, sitting at a table with a peer group, learning about what they're working on and understanding that there were more resources immediately available in this community. That's the key word, community. So we promote ourselves through the people, through the community, through that feeling. The second thing is I'm a huge evangelist for LinkedIn.
Me too.
LinkedIn is the greatest thing that has happened to us, especially folks without marketing budgets. I try to be active on behalf of the FCS on my personal feed on LinkedIn. We have a company page, and we also have, I made reference earlier on, we have about 2,000 people in our FCS group. We are trying to put out at least weekly information about what our activities are. And it's those two channels that have really led to our success, and we are thriving. The notion that we went into the pandemic when we got that shutdown notice that we weren't going to be able to do any more in-person events. A lot of people could have just folded up the tent, but we were able to pivot like so many other companies. And we were very grateful that what happened for us is that our CMOs stepped up. We had 32 CMOs in our first season all agree. At one point, we did 16 weekly virtual sessions. When they stepped up to support us, that told the community how important the FCS surviving was. So we're very grateful to all of those CMOs. And that continues today. We have an amazing lineup looking at 2022.
Yeah, that's so awesome. I keep wondering what the new normal is going to look like after this is over. I was familiar with Zoom because the coach training program I went through, they did all of the virtual training back in 2017 on Zoom. So I was very familiar with it. But many people weren't. And now anybody who doesn't know Zoom has been living under a rock. So what are you thinking the outcome of this is going to be? Do you think that you'll have more virtual events going forward? I mean, I can't wait to get back into rooms with people, but it's also been really convenient to be able to be like, oh, I don't have to travel. I don't need to get on the train and go into the city. I can fit a session in between other things I have going on.
The solution for the FCS is, I think, something that's going to be embraced across the industry, and that's simply hybrid. We've been doing in-person events. We came back in New York last September, and we have been doing them on a regular basis. We've had our portfolio in person with 225 people in September. In December, we had our marketer of the year with 110 people. Did I mention they were all vaccinated? We had 125 people up at Stowe. So the pattern is back. It's going to take a while for our numbers to increase again, but that's also a reflection of whether or not people, in our case, are in Manhattan already. And then say, okay, I'm in Manhattan. I'm going to go to this FCS event. It is raising the stakes for us to create more significant events. Or what I mean by that is, instead of come out for a 45-minute breakfast or come to lunch, which is 2 hours in your day, we're looking at the idea of, if we need to bring people into the city to come to an event, then let's give them more. So let's give them a full morning. Maybe we'll go to a full day. We have a history of doing education conferences. In the past, we've done them 2 days, we've done full day, we've done half day. We will probably look to do some of those maybe on a quarterly basis, and not just in New York, but where our other chapters are as well. The idea there is, it's staying true to our brand, but it's giving people more of a reason to choose not to work remotely on that given day, come into our event and get not only the exposure on the content, but also the great networking opportunity.
Yeah.
Having said that, we are committed to continue to do at least monthly virtual events for the foreseeable future. Because the beautiful thing about that is, whereas I rattled off the 10 cities that we have done events in the past, because we've been on Zoom for the better part of 2 years, we now have members and corporate members across the country, admittedly in cities we may never choose to do an in-person event, but we're very proud of being a national organization. In fact, we are technically global in the sense that when you look at our audience, our virtual audience, we've had people from 16 different countries around the world tune in to FCS events on Zoom.
Yeah, I think that that's one of the great advantages of, I mean, if we can look at the glass half full, right, of this time that we've gone through. I mean, I started the podcast during the pandemic because I wasn't able to meet with people in person. And the nice thing is that I actually posted a podcast on LinkedIn today that I was on maybe a month or so ago with somebody in England, right? I mean, I talked to people all over the world during this time because you can tune in with anybody virtually. I think it's really nice. Well, before we wrap up, I just want to briefly ask about, you've got a publishing imprint, right?
Yeah.
So before I go into this, because I know that you're such a great advocate for your clients and you're such a great advocate for the FCS and you're very talented, but also kind of humble when it comes to yourself. And I think that a lot of marketers are very creative people and like to do writing and maybe artwork or whatever, just expressing themselves. And I mentioned really briefly that you like to write short fiction. So tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, first of all, I have to point out that pretty much everyone in your audience has just fallen off the chair laughing at the sentence that Kevin Windorf is humble. And that'll be the day. But thank you for mentioning. Yeah, so two quick things. I mentioned that I've been a writer. I've been a writer pretty much my entire life. I did a lot of that through school. And as I pointed out, to my great advantage, I've been able to leverage that for career decisions. And when you get hired to do writing, and then that leads itself to marketing, that's just a fantastic opportunity to basically exploit a skill. And then when I was an independent brand consultant, that really, you know, saved the day for me and allowed me to build up a reputation where I was, for the most part, a fairly highly sought after writer, which, you know, I'm very proud of. Somewhere along the lines, I started to find the time or make the time to formalize the short fiction that I was writing. A friend of mine named Matt Hickerson had been on the FCS board, he's a client. He had done some self-publishing and showed me the ropes on how to do that. And I started to think long-term that when I ultimately do retire, because I'm a workaholic and I can't imagine ever stop working, but when I stop looking for a paycheck from the agency world or whoever else is going to deal with me for the next couple of years, I realized I would love to have a publishing imprint. So to start to explore what that would be like, over the last couple of years, I've published 3 collections of short fiction, which I've really enjoyed the experience. People have been very polite. I've been very supportive of the works that I've put out there. Some of them are suspense, some are comedy, a little bit on the dry side. If you know my sense of humor, you'll get it. But nothing makes me prouder than to see my name on the spine of a book on a bookshelf. And I know that you're also an author and you know exactly what this is like to be able to have taken the time to create a book, in my case, works of fiction, which I've always enjoyed telling stories, and these have been great stories that I've liked to share, and then to put them in print or to be able to call up on the Kindle on an app and read stuff. And I had this really great fortune. I entered a short story in a contest with NPR, and they picked to do a little bit of a recording. So I've got this soundbite of people performing about 3 minutes of a short story. And that's just, as a creative person, that's just a wonderful, wonderful feeling. So, yeah, you might have to wait until I retire to see a greater collection of works. But I do try to challenge myself that at least once a year, I get something published. So Quindorian Press, but you can find out all about me and my short fiction at kevinwindorf.com.
Yeah, after our pre-call, I went out and I read one of your short stories. I think, is it called Fat Franny?
Fat, yeah, I can't believe you picked that one to read. Yeah, Fat Francine.
Francine, yeah. Okay, yeah. Well, I know you've got kids, I've got kids, and I was like, oh, this is, yeah, that's definitely comedy and kind of a slice of life. I thought it was funny. Yeah, and I like the title too, so I think that's what drew me in. So yeah, well, check it out. Kevin, I enjoyed that story, and I don't know if you would agree with this, I think you probably would, that publishing a book is kind of like having another kid. Like you put a lot of effort, at least my book is 380 pages. If I'd known that it was going to be that long, I would have written two books instead of one, but I was a little dumb, I guess, as I was writing.
I like the analogy of it being like having another kid, because I've got three kids then sitting on a bookshelf and I don't want anyone to make fun of them.
Yeah, exactly. You put a lot of effort into it. And then once they're out there, they're kind of have a life of their own. And it can feel a little tough, right, to put it out there like, oh, I'm sending you off out into the world.
Well, you know, ultimately, we're communicators, and it's all about storytelling and sharing.
Yep, absolutely. Well, Kevin, this was really a lot of fun. I'm so glad that we've reconnected. Why don't you tell our listeners where they can find out more information about the FCS, about Living Group, and you mentioned your website, kevinwindorf.com, if they want to learn more about Quindorian Press or read any of your short stories, which I would recommend that people do if you want to be entertained.
Great. Well, thanks, Terry. I really enjoyed this conversation. And again, I've been a fan of Marketing Mamba, and I was hoping you'd invite me to dance. So this has been great. And everyone who's interested in financial marketing, please check out the FCS. Our website is thefcs.org. So thefcs.org. And I am the client strategist director for Living Group, which is living-group.com. And we specialize in financial marketing, also professional services. And for those of you who are curious about some unusual short fiction, please go to my website, kevinwindorf.com. And I do have some short stories that are up there that are immediately available to read. And then my three books you can download or buy through Amazon and probably me if you call me up and I'll drive over to your house and see what I got in the trunk.
Okay. And I am assuming that you would love to get connected with anybody on LinkedIn that is interested.
I'm huge on LinkedIn, and the folks at LinkedIn should start paying me because I'm such an evangelist for them. LinkedIn is just an amazing platform for professionals.
I completely agree. So check out Kevin on LinkedIn as well. What's your handle there? Is it just Kevin Windorf?
Just Kevin Windorf. It's okay. Great to have a name where you're the only one.
Yeah.
And again, FCS is on LinkedIn. We have a company page. You also have a group page. You can follow us there as well.
Great. Well, Kevin, thanks so much for being a guest today.
Thank you, Terry. Great talking with you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Marketing Mambo. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe, like, and share. I'd love to hear from you. Check out the show notes for my social media and contact information. Until next time, adios.